This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 140 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I feel like Tuesday's show was like my stairway to heaven. I went on and on about Superflex Leagues for 25 minutes, you guys. I usually keep this thing under 20. But because you've heard my annoying voice too much this week, which, by the way, according to some Reddit posts, it's confirmed that some people do indeed hate my voice. And I'm really sorry, but I don't have the ability to change it. But because you've heard my annoying voice way too much this week, I've got nothing planned for the intro today. We're just gonna dig right into these mailbag questions, so let's do it. This first question says, "Hey JJ, love the show. I noticed when you were going over data, you disregarded the stats from week 17. While I realize those games don't typically take place during the fantasy season, aren't they still helpful for producing a larger sample size to predict future results? For example, Leonard Fournette played 12 games from weeks 1 through 16, but played an additional 4 games counting week 17 in the playoffs. Wouldn't it make sense to use those games as they provide 33% more information on a player? Thank you, Joe." So the main reason I don't generally cite playoff statistics is because not all teams make the playoffs. If I'm talking specifically about a player, if I'm talking about specifically about, say, Leonard Fournette, then sure, I'll reference his numbers throughout all games. I'll talk about how he did in the playoffs and so on. But when I'm analyzing something like usable or elite weeks that players compile, I need to do so in an environment where each player's played the same number of games. And since week 17 can be somewhat of a dumpster fire depending on playoff situations, I don't want to skew those numbers. Some guys in week 17 aren't playing full games, while others aren't playing at all. Basically, if I'm doing high-level work where I'm looking at how positions perform as a group, for example, I'm going to try and limit things to weeks 1 through 16 to keep everyone on a level playing field. If I need to quickly reference season-long stats, they'll more than likely include week 17. So in the end, I would say that I don't limit all of my analysis to just weeks 1 through 16. It depends on the type of analysis that's actually being done. This next question is from Twitter. It's from @WhatTheChain. Which team's coaching staff concerns you the most? I think I could answer this a lot of different ways. From a head coaching perspective, the easy answer is Hugh Jackson. He handled the quarterback situation in Cleveland like garbage last year, and while the Browns weren't a good team in 2017, they definitely weren't a zero-win team. That's on the coach. That's on the coaching staff. But if we're talking about which coaching staffs I may be down on for fantasy purposes this year, or coaching staffs who I believe won't come close to maximizing talent on their teams, I think you've got to look at Seattle and what they're doing. I've ranted and talked about it before on the show, so I won't go into that much detail here, but everything that they've said and everything that they've done this offseason points to them wanting to be this run-heavy team. But their defense isn't what it was even 2 years ago, their offensive line still needs work, and they have Russell freaking Wilson. Given what data says and what I've studied, wanting to be a running team makes very little sense in today's NFL, let alone wanting to be a running team when you have one of the better quarterbacks in the league on your roster. Previous podcasts that I've done dig into this a bit more, though. And I think you have to look at Oakland and be a little bit nervous, too. A lot of their decisions this offseason have been head-scratchers. Namely, their choice to continuously bring in these aged players who have passed their peak NFL age. And then they trade a decent pick from Martavis Bryant, who's one move away from a huge suspension. I just don't really trust John Gruden in 2018. Those are two that just popped into my head when I saw this question. I don't want to go into too much detail because I talked about both staffs a good bit this offseason, but that's who I'll go with. This next question is from @mhammer43 on Twitter. Which teams do you anticipate having a top 10 offense in the NFL would help for targeting running backs? So the real thing that you want to do is not just look at those offenses, but look at good offenses who also have cheap running backs. So you can look at Green Bay, New England, and Philadelphia as three teams with committee systems where not only will someone in that committee likely have a usable week most weeks, but someone may just full-blown emerge from that committee. This ties back to the podcast on how to spot a running back breakout, and why I mentioned Corey Clement, the entire Packers backfield, and Rex Burkhead as later round players to target this year. If you want my top 10 offenses as of right now heading into the year, I'll go with New Orleans, New England, Green Bay, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Minnesota, both LA teams, and I'll have fun with number 10 and I'll say Kansas City. Naturally, a lot of those spots have high cost running backs because their situations will be embedded in their average draft positions. But like I said, New England, Green Bay, and Philadelphia are three teams where targeting their running backs is a smart move, in my opinion. This next question is from @GuamDon. In listening to the latest pod about Superflex leagues, I wonder how you view this season's landscape given the likelihood of several teams having two to three starters this year, like the Bills, Browns, Cardinals, and Jets, shrinking the supply of consistent starters, more so for best ball leagues. Yeah, so with best ball leagues, I think you have to pay up for safety a bit. As I mentioned on the Superflex pod, while I'm definitely planning to draft my quarterbacks later than a lot of other owners in that league, I still recognize that the supply can dry up fast. And your goal should be to get middle-of-the-road starters who are surely going to be starters all season long at the quarterback position. If you draft someone like Sam Bradford in a regular season-long Superflex league, you can correct that because you're making transactions throughout the season. But you're not in a best ball league, which is why you have to pay up a little bit more for safety. In a regular league, though, you could look at this season in two ways. The first way is that it's a crappy one because you can't get as many secured guys late. But you could also view it as sweet because there will probably be waiver wire starters later in the season. So it's up to how you want to handle it. I think the greater point is that players like Andy Dalton or Ryan Tannehill, who no one wants, are still very good two quarterback league pieces. We know they'll have their jobs all year unless they get hurt, and they're predictable each week. And if you guys haven't listened to that Superflex pod, do it to it. It's episode 139, the one right before this one. This next one's from Twitter from @Oscar_Mike. What are your thoughts of Eli Manning earning NFL Comeback Player of the Year? So Wikipedia says the National Football League Comeback Player of the Year Award refers to a number of awards that are given to a National Football League player who has shown perseverance in overcoming adversity in the form of not being in the NFL the previous year, a severe injury, or simply poor performance. So technically, I guess Eli could qualify because he wasn't very good last year. Do I think that he's going to win it? No, I don't think he's going to win it. I think if someone wins that award without having sustained an injury of some sort the year before, he's probably got to be MVP-like. And I don't see that happening for Eli Manning. But I do think that Eli is a low-key, decent target in fantasy football drafts. My buddy Rich Rebar from RotoWorld tweeted a great stat out earlier this month that said, looking further at the Eli ADP versus his skill players, over the past 20 years, there have been 32 teams with a fantasy RB1, wide receiver one and tight end one the same season, and just once has their quarterback finished lower than QB14 overall. So basically, if Evan Ingram, Saquon Barkley, and OBJ all meet expectation, Eli should exceed his expectation. And as Rich also noted, the same goes for Pat Mahomes right now too. This next one's from Twitter from @Laricky. Do you draft any differently in a 10-team league as opposed to a 12-team league? Thanks. I don't do a whole lot different in a 10-team league versus a 12-team league, no. But I will say that the smaller the league, the more inclined I am to try and start to maximize my quarterback and tight end slots, because in those smaller leagues, you need every single edge that you can get. Because every single team is stacked. Every team is good. So when that's the case, you need to really try your best to get one of the two or so quarterbacks and tight ends who are actually giving you a significant edge each week. I'm not saying that I'm getting Aaron Rodgers in the second round, but just that I go more for that perfect lineup in smaller leagues. It is easier to stream in those smaller leagues, but streaming probably won't yield anything better than something like a QB4, even when your options are great on the waiver wire. Now, don't get me wrong, streaming's great in most leagues. We've been streaming QB6 Frankensteins for years over on my other podcast, Living the Stream. But the point of streaming is value-related, and it's not to completely own your league mates at the quarterback position. It's that you know not any single roster is going to be flawless, so you're intelligently picking where your roster will lack. You want your roster to lack at a replaceable position. But in like a 6-team league or an 8-team league, no rosters are going to be bad. So you've got to win everywhere. This next question is from @ColinLundstrom. If Chris Carson is the better running back option coming out of camp in the preseason, how much does "but we drafted Penny in the first" weigh into your decision? I know this sounds weird, but there's no blanket way of answering this because each team will react to a situation like this differently. Like, you should assume that teams are just going to play the best player. If Chris Carson is the best player, he should be on the field. But it's not like we're going to enter week one of the regular season with absolutely no idea as to how much work Chris Carson is going to get if he dominates in the preseason. We'll know. Beat writers will help tell us, the team will tell us, and so on. They won't tell us exactly how big that workload will be, but we'll at least have some idea as to what that workload looks like. That's why I say that right now, there's no easy way to answer that question. Do I think the fact that they drafted Penny in round one will influence their decision? Yes, I think there's going to be bias there. I also want to clear up something that happened earlier in the offseason when answering a mailbag question where I said that Royce Freeman and Rashad Penny have their backfields locked up. This was back in May. Some of you might not even remember it. When I answered that question, I really just meant that compared to the rest of the players we were talking about at the time, that they were easily the most locked into their roles. I still believe both players will see a significant role for their teams. But I'm also very open to my mind changing because we're talking about two rookies in offenses that may look a lot different than they did last year. So my apologies if that didn't come across the way that it was intended to come across. I still expect Penny and Freeman to have big roles, but I don't think it's 100% for certain right now because nothing is. And for the record, there is nothing that I want to see more than for a team to foolishly spend a first-round pick on a running back when they have so many other holes on the roster, just to see a second-year seventh-round pick coming off an injury take his job. That would be absolutely amazing. I also own a lot of Chris Carson across my dynasty team, so that would be a plus too. But guess what? None of you guys care about my fantasy team, so let's move on. This next one's from @TXMattyIce13. Who's your favorite late-round tight end prospect? Ebron and Austin Seferian Jenkins are interesting, but hard to predict being on new teams. Guys like Seals Jones, Vance McDonald, and Jake Butt are possible breakout candidates. So who do you see producing this year and beyond out of guys like this? So when you say late round here, you clearly mean like late round. Because I think that George Kittle is probably my favorite regular late round tight end who can get into that top five range if things kind of go the right way for him this season. The 49ers don't have a ton of competition for targets, and if you're buying into Jimmy G, it makes sense to buy into George Kittle as well. To me though, I don't see a clear-cut must-have guy who's going super late. I think if you're planning on drafting an Ebron or a McDonald type, you're entering the season looking to stream the position. Ricky Seals-Jones is someone I'm intrigued by given competition there as well, and he flashed some nice efficiency last season. I really just don't have a preference with what late round tight end you go with because if we're being honest, here in June, there aren't many of them with firm roles in their offense. I think the players that you named are absolutely fine, but I also think my tight end strategy is going to focus on getting someone in that George Kittle range, whether it's him or maybe Jordan Reed when he falls, because we know that Jordan Reed has a really, really high ceiling. This next one is from Twitter from @JoshErsley. What are your honest-to-God thoughts on zero RB this year? It was great the last couple of years, but after 20-ish best balls, it gets really thin, really fast after around the 12th highest ranked. I'm not much of a zero RB drafter. I don't do it very often in redraft leagues, but when I do, it's specifically in formats where I can start four wide receivers and when I'm getting a full point per reception. A lot of research that I've done through the years suggests that having an elite running back in fantasy football is by far the biggest advantage that you can have. So I will modify zero RB at times and lock in someone I feel is in that elite running back range, like one of the top backs this year, and then pound receiver after that. This year in particular is really tough for me. And it goes back to what I talked about on episode 127 about reacting to last season's results. Realistically, this is probably a good zero RB year, and that a lot of good wide receivers are dropping in drafts and more pseudo bell cow backs are entering the picture. That makes the real bell cow backs not as valuable. If there's more competition against them, that makes them less valuable. The problem you may run into in drafts, though, is that running back is still drying up pretty fast. You don't feel as confident in that position as you do wide receiver when you hit rounds 4, 5, and so on. So to me, it's pretty similar to how I've drafted the last couple of seasons. I'm fully prepared for a passing game bounce back this year over 2017, and think that if you're in the back half of the first round, getting a wide receiver makes a ton of sense, at least one. But I've done a lot of drafts where I've got the first overall pick, and I'm scooping up Le'Veon Bell, then getting Devontae Freeman, and then a wide receiver like Adam Thielen at the 2-3 turn. And I can be pretty flexible from there because, like I said, I'm digging the middle round wide receivers more than I am running backs. But I do think this is actually a far better year for zero RB than what we saw last year, given the prices of these players. I'm not sure I'll fully implement the strategy, but this year it'll be less common to go zero RB, and anytime that's the case for any strategy, it benefits the person implementing that strategy. This last question is from @FantasyStack. Your late round quarterback strategy has to be at the very top of universally accepted fantasy football strategies that actually help gain an advantage, and that's truly incredible. My question is, have you ever had doubts about the strategy since first writing about it? I have doubts about everything that I say and do because I'm a human being. So yes, I think there have been some doubts. That's especially true early on. Nowadays, things are easy when it comes to backing the strategy and writing about it because you get fewer people coming at you for answers. Back in 2012 through probably like 2014 or 2015, I feel like 80% of my social media interaction was having to defend the strategy. And when you're constantly having to do that, you naturally doubt yourself. Even though so many people were on my side of the argument for the strategy, if a lot of people aren't on your side with anything, you have to at some point wonder why. But in the back of my head, I was always confident in what I was writing and explaining. And it's because the strategy is one that's just a part of what fantasy football is as a game. Like, it's so basic. It's why many, many people were drafting quarterbacks late in their fantasy football leagues before I came in and wrote a long study on it. I'm not the first person to draft a quarterback late in fantasy football. I'm just the person who marketed the strategy the most, and I did it at a time where it wasn't universally accepted to do. I have doubts all the time with this stuff because this is a game of forecasting and predicting. If you don't have doubts, I think that you're doing it wrong. Variance is a real thing, and you know that you're not always going to be 100% right. But I also don't want that to be twisted into me lacking confidence in the strategy. The reason the strategy works is because it doesn't really matter what happens within the game of football itself. Basic supply and demand tells us that quarterbacks should be devalued in fantasy football. And then when there's more quarterback competition like we see these days, it only makes the strategy that much more worthwhile. That's it for today's show, though. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Google Play. And when you're on iTunes, do me a favor and leave a rating and review. I'm also on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.